The states with the most egregious abortion bans are also the states with the worst maternal health outcomes, no care infrastructure, the lowest investment in childcare overall, no paid family leave. So it's the perfect storm for what Dalia laid out. You're going to have a forced birth nation with no benefits and rights and services for the pregnant person. And then we're going to make children the wards of the state. What kind of dystopian nightmare is this? Well, it's happening right now in places like Mississippi and Alabama.
Hello, and welcome to the Politics Girl podcast. I'm your host, Lee McGowan. Let's get into it. As reproductive rights are stripped from women across the country, contraception is once again on the line, IVF is already banned in Alabama, and Trump, no matter what he tries to gaslight us into believing, is ready to sign a national abortion ban should he win the presidency again, the people of America have to get really serious, really fast, about what we think freedom truly is and who we believe deserves it. Because the Republicans are being incredibly clear that they see freedom as contingent. Contingent on your gender, contingent on your sexuality, on your color, on your religion. And if you don't subscribe to their particular values and views, then freedom is simply a word that stands for nothing. With that in mind, today's pod is a conversation with Mini Timaraju, president of Reproductive Freedom for All, previously NARAL Pro-Choice America, who is here to remind us what's really going on in this country of ours when it comes to reproductive rights. Before becoming president of Reproductive Freedom for All, Minnie was a senior advisor on DEI and accessibility policy for the Biden-Harris administration, served as a National Women's Vote Director for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, and was an instrumental member of Planned Parenthood. She joined the organization with over 20 years' experience leading all levels of political campaigns, as well as advocacy efforts around reproductive rights, gender, and racial justice. I'm having her on today to remind everyone of what's at stake in the upcoming election. Not just the continuation of free and fair elections, but the autonomy over our bodies, our rights to personal freedoms, and our privacy in this country. It doesn't matter if you have never voted in your life. This is something everyone must do now. We have to collectively tell those who would strip our freedoms from us that enough is enough, and we have to say it so loudly and proudly at the ballot box. So without further ado, please welcome my guest, seasoned campaigner, gifted team builder, and president of Reproductive Freedom for All, Mini Timaraju. Welcome, Mini.
So good to see you again, and nice to be on the show.
Well, thanks for coming back. You know, I love you. I love your work. But man, this country has just gone off the rails when it comes to reproductive freedom since you were last here. I mean, how does the team at Reproductive Freedom for All even know which battle to fight these days when the attacks are coming from all sides?
Yeah, you know, I've been on a lot of calls with donors, with coalition leaders, with members of Congress, candidates, party committees. They always ask me, like, what are you working on? Is it this or that? Is it up or down? And I'm like, it's all of the above. And for better or for worse, you know, when the Supreme Court said they're kicking this over to the states, I mean, they weren't telling the truth, right? This was never going to be just, okay, well, it's in the states now, so we're going to just do state work. You know, there's still so much troublemaking that is happening in Congress. There's still so many threats to our fundamental freedoms in the courts. We had two Supreme Court oral arguments in the last month, medication abortion, emergency abortion care. And we've had, you know, House and Senate Republicans and the Heritage Foundation laying out big plans for how they can destroy access even further at the federal level. So how do we do it? We're picking places and lanes where our work can layer. And ultimately, what we've done is shifted a lot of our work to be grassroots organizing, which is why it's always so great to be on a show like yours and with your listeners.
Yeah, they're so great.
Because it's all about person-to-person mobilization. So if I'm in Arizona and I'm working on a ballot initiative and flipping the legislature and a critical U.S. Senate race, what's the common denominator for all of those things? It's the people. It's getting people mobilized. So that's what we're really focused on this year is increasing our membership, moving folks up the ladder of engagement, which means like maybe you clicked on an email, but maybe tomorrow you'll give us $25. Maybe next week you'll show up on a Zoom to learn more. And maybe by the summer you're an active volunteer and by the fall you're voting, but your friends and family are voting too. So like, how do we move folks up? And that's what we need. We need a people-powered movement to fight back because the fight, as you said, the incoming is so fast and furious, but we can win and beat them back together.
Yeah, I completely believe that. I mean, so let me ask you, is one of the reasons for the rebrand of your organization, where you used to be NARAL Pro-Choice America, is now called Reproductive Freedom for All, is it just because the mission itself got bigger? Everything that you're dealing with now falls under a far bigger umbrella and you needed a different moniker to hold all that?
You know, I would love to say we were that brilliant and we did it that way. I'll say a couple of things. But there was some brilliance involved. You know, my predecessor, Elise Hoag, who a lot of you know, is a really brilliant, you know, messenger and communicator. And she, after Trump won in 2016, you know, she and the team at NARAL started to think about how do we meet this post, you know, Trump moment, understanding that all of our freedoms are under attack. And they started using this reproductive freedom frame, this freedom frame message, and shifting from the choice life binary. Many, many reasons. Like one being that it was less effective. You know, we kind of lost some of the messaging war when it came to choice and life. But also that for many folks in states with restrictions, pre-Roe, while Roe was still on the books, they didn't have choices. Like if there's one abortion clinic in your state, like Mississippi was in the Dobbs case, do I really have a choice? If I'm a person of color, I'm an immigrant, I'm in a rural area, I'm lower income, and we don't have funding for abortion care, do I really have a choice? So the organization was already going through this rebranding question. So post Dobbs, you know, we knew that we had this really cool like opportunity to change the brand, that we'd started shifting to this reproductive freedom message framework. So we went back and we dug a little bit. We did the research, we did the message testing. And what kept popping up was the for all. Like we knew we wanted to use reproductive freedom, but we also knew we were in this moment where we had to demonstrate inclusion and the broadest agenda for the broadest range of Americans as possible. And we also knew that post Dobbs, more Americans than ever wanted to be part of something. So if we could frame and reframe our message and our brand to be the most inclusive, like you can be younger, you can be older, you can be Black, you can be white, you can be a man, you can be a woman, you can be gender nonconforming, non-binary. We wanted to be that home, that political home for the movement. So it really dovetailed nicely with this post-Dobbs response. And we were very nervous about it, you know, but it's been tremendously successful and way more engagement than we expected to have. You always think you're going to have a drop-off when you change your name, and we didn't. So it's been exciting because I think it captures where people are. And reproductive freedom is the message that since 2022 to now has been the winning message with the American people when we talk about abortion access and rights.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go back to talk about some of those attacks because we recently had the far right Arizona Supreme Court uphold an abortion law from 1864, which thankfully might have the chance of being overturned in the Arizona legislature. We'll watch that happen. Yep. Florida.
Yeah, I can tell you more about that too, if you want.
We are going to talk about all of it. Florida is moving from a 15-week ban to a 6-week ban. Texas, who already have some of the most outrageous anti-abortion, anti-choice laws on the books, now have extremists trying to block roads so people can't get to the airport or out of state to have abortions. Alabama has more or less outlawed IVF. And the right to the abortion drug mifepristone, as you mentioned, is at the Supreme Court right now. And they could essentially rule to make it illegal, which would cut down the access to a majority of people in America who use that drug as their main form of abortion care. And they're also deliberating how close to the verge of death doctors in Idaho can let women get before they treat them with an abortion. And that's those things I mentioned are just scratching the surface of what we're dealing with across the country.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's an onslaught, as you said. Yeah. I mean, again, what's important to note is that when Dobbs happened, right, when Roe was destroyed, it opened the door for so many other attacks, right? That having Roe as the floor, and Roe was not perfect, but having Roe as the floor as like a baseline of protection for abortion access and rights was able to sort of block a lot of the anti-abortion extremist efforts around a range of other issues, birth control, IVF, you know, protecting patients and providers, right? You know, making sure folks can practice medicine in an ethical, effective way where they don't have to like turn away a patient because of a possible pregnancy outcome, criminalization of women who have miscarriages. So what's become really clear is without Roe, like undergirding like your fundamental freedoms, just a Pandora's box of bad, bad things can happen in this country, right? So now We're trying to restore the Roe framework as a baseline, but we're also in this unique position of being able to, it's a terrible way to have to do it, but of being able to expose what we've been tracking as reproductive rights, health and justice organizations for decades, which is this dark underbelly, evil, you know, anti-abortion movement that's rooted in really extremist theology, right? It's all about power and control. These are the same folks who murdered Dr. George Tiller, you know, in Kansas, the abortion provider decades ago. These are the same folks who are outside clinics intimidating patients and screaming. But, you know, in Arizona, they were the same people just a few weeks ago that were in the gallery in the legislature shouting scripture at the legislators when they were talking about repealing the abortion ban. So it's kind of forced these people into the front and into the limelight. And it's allowed us to make the case to the American people that these folks are nuts.
That's like, too extreme. It's too much.
Never been about choice and life. They're not pro-life. They are willing to let American women die in their pursuit of power and control. So it's horrific, but we have an opportunity to take these actions and turn it into, in my mind, we've just got to put them out of business. Kind of like what we've done with the NRA. Like, how do we take this horror show, put these folks out of business, and restore and expand rights as fast as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Idaho is the best example of that right now. With you've got the Supreme Court discussing these super strict laws that are on the books in Idaho, which only allows doctors to intervene if the woman is near death. So they're discussing like what that means, right? So if she loses her uterus, is that enough? If she's going to be sick for the rest of her life, is that enough? If she's in agonizing pain, is that enough? And I heard Planned Parenthood's Alexis McGill Johnson saying, the state of Idaho is literally arguing for the right to deny patients emergency abortion care, even if it means they could die. And then she said, I'm going to repeat that. The Supreme Court will soon decide if our opponents really have the right to let us die. And then I keep thinking about when the Republicans made up all those stories about death panels during the discussion around the Affordable Care Act.
That's what this is.
Right? And you're like, here are your death panels, babe. Like, this is what's happening. And
death panels are lawyers and legislators and politicians.
Yeah.
They're not even doctors. So Alexis makes this point often. This is a brilliant analysis. I'll add to it. And this is something Alexis has said. So I don't want to take credit for it, but they're also willing to let white women die. This is important. They've been willing to let brown and black and brown women, gay women, you know, LGBTQ women, you know, die for decades. But now they're willing to let women like you die. This is like another level, right? So it's like, wake up, white women who didn't all support Hillary Clinton in 2016. Yeah. They are coming for you too, because some of the most egregious, terrible cases of these pregnancy complications later in pregnancy that are the most publicized stories are white women, Amanda Zarefsky, you know, Kate Cox, Austin Denard, privileged white women who have the ability to leave the state. The Idaho case, the oral arguments in the Idaho case, I've been doing this work for almost 20 years. I thought I was kind of like dead inside a little bit. Like, I hear horror stories every day. I was listening to the Idaho counsel in making the arguments to the court, listening to the women justices like eviscerate him. Even Amy Coney Barrett
Like, look, if you've lost Amy Coney Barrett.
Like, remembered she had a uterus. She was like, what? What? She was literally, yeah, I can't even, it was so appalling how calmly he was dissecting the question you just laid out.
Yeah.
Well, it's really up to a medical provider. It's really up to their judgment. He wouldn't answer whether it would be enough to almost die.
Yeah, no, the chief physician executive at St. Luke's Health System in Idaho was saying, you know, that the doctors are like, is she sick enough? Is she bleeding enough? Is she septic enough? And the guessing game becomes so uncomfortable that they said, we're just transferring patients out at this extremely high cost because they don't want the liability. They're just not allowed to practice medicine. Like, what are we doing? And the Lincoln Project, Tara Stoudemire, she was just on CNN and she said, I have a few things to say about the Idaho abortion case that it really comes down to. There are real-world consequences for these draconian laws. There is no D or R next to the name of the women bleeding out in ER lobbies. You know, like, we're not talking about anymore, like you said, we're not talking about their color, how poor they are, who they know, who their friends are. These are just repressive draconian laws that they're just straight up putting on all women and all pregnant people.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I think two other points about Idaho. Number one, Idaho is now becoming a healthcare desert. So many doctors and providers have left the state that, you know, it's not just these crisis cases needing to be airlifted. It's also like, do you want to practice there? Right. And many physicians are just saying, no, I'm not going to go to Idaho. I'm not going to go to a state like Idaho. Number one. Number two, if you think about this case, and it's the EMTALA case, a statute, a federal statute that has federal funding to hospitals. So, and it was originally designed around just taking care of poor people. Like, if I'm a poor person and I go to a hospital that gets federal funding and I'm dying, the hospital can't turn me away because I don't have insurance, because I'm in an emergency. I'm in a crisis. That's what this law was designed for. And they're saying abortion doesn't count. Abortion can't be a life-saving mechanism. So here's what I say to that. An Idaho attorney kept arguing, Idaho has exceptions. The Idaho law has exceptions. We have exceptions to this that would account for these cases. EMTALA, you could very well think about it as the ultimate exception. And you know, you've heard me on your show and other shows say, exceptions don't work. They're designed to fail. They're a political tactic for Republicans to make folks feel better about an abortion ban. So here we have the ultimate exception, emergency care. Someone is dying and they need abortion to save their life. And they're taking it to the Supreme Court. This is proof. They've never cared about our lives. And they've never, ever planned to enforce a single exception. So I just ask all our Democratic friends, stop talking about the exceptions. Just remember, it's all bullshit. It's a veneer. We don't want to even give them that because they don't care about our lives.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you were really smart when you were saying earlier, like, we have to keep in mind that the Dobbs decision really just opened the door to every extremist limiting, criminalizing, banning idea that is out there around pregnancy or reproductive care, because it's including everything from birth control to abortion to IVF. Like, it is not just about abortion care anymore. It is about control and power.
It never was.
Yeah, but you can really see it now. And I like what that reminds me of is I go back to legal expert Dahlia Lithwick, who I love so much. And she wrote an article saying that she actually thinks there's something way darker going on that's more than just forcing people to have children. She argues that these decisions have to do with our country's history with power and with money and with ownership of children in general. It's not just about if we're going to force you to have children. It's about who gets to raise them. And she wrote this article back. Yeah, it's just amazing. She wrote this article back in Slate in February that has stuck with me for months. And she was basically explaining that she sees what's happening as kind of a two-step situation where the state forces women to have babies that they can't raise and does nothing to support them in doing that. Then they swoop in and take the babies when the parents are seen as endangering them, which of course will fall more heavily on poor women and women of color. Then they move these babies through a for-profit or Christian-based adoption agencies and give them to more worthy parents, which of course, at the very least, means a heterosexual couple or Christian parents. And as Dahlia points out, these far-right extremists are now building the ability to do this into the legal framework of our states. And I think we have to be really honest that all of these cases around the country, it's bigger than abortion. Like, when Republicans are insisting that life begins at conception, what they're saying is we need babies so badly in our society that someone should always be entitled to take control.
White babies, by the way.
Yeah, so they here's really what I would like white, more white babies, yeah.
The callback is Amy Coney Barrett during the Dobbs oral arguments saying these words, a domestic supply of infants, quote unquote. She literally made that observation. Well, on the bright side, this could create a domestic supply of infants.
Yeah.
I mean, let me be clear. I'm an adoptive parent. You know, I adopted my children. They are not white. I'm really privileged that I was able to do this. But ultimately, as a society, we should be investing in keeping families together, not tearing families apart. And the states with the most egregious abortion bans are also the states with the worst maternal health outcomes, no care infrastructure, the lowest investment in childcare overall, no paid family leave. So it's the perfect storm for what Dalia laid out. You're going to have a forced birth nation with no benefits and rights and services for the pregnant person. And then we're going to make children the wards of the state. What kind of dystopian nightmare is this? Well, it's happening right now in places like Mississippi and Alabama.
Yeah.
And it has been happening pre-Roe, but now it's out in the light of day.
Yeah. I just, reading her work, it was just terrifying, not only just because she's really smart and she really gets it, but the concept of it is a much bigger issue, which is like how I'd like my audience to start thinking about it, that it's not just about controlling women or about controlling our fertility or even about the power to make economic and health decisions about somebody else's life. This is about the government making determinations over what we do with our own bodies, but also who is fit to be a parent and who is not.
Yes.
And I just... Dalia likens it to the childhood separation policy that MAGA put in when they were in control, that they want to bring back when they're back in office, which is, of course, if you don't remember, the policy where the government took children away from their parents and then placed them with better families. And it's what Putin is doing to the Ukrainian children, stealing them from their families and putting them with...
what we did to Native American children.
We did with Native American children, absolutely. And it's like, we're going to give them to the people who are going to raise them right, that are going to do it correctly. So if you get rid of surrogacy, which they're talking about, and you get rid of IVF, suddenly gay people can't be parents. You get rid of abortion, suddenly poor people have to have babies, but they can't raise them, so you take them. This all sort of leads up to, like you were saying, that thing that ended up as a footnote in Justice Alito's decision about this domestic supply of infants. And I really think we need to think really big about this because it does feel dystopian and it's also entirely plausible. The Politics Girl podcast is sponsored by Factor. Factor is a fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meal in just 2 minutes. 2 minutes. No joke. This isn't your average prepared meal or like the frozen food section at your grocery store food. These are restaurant-quality dishes that are ready to heat whenever you're ready to eat. We're talking meals like garlic filet mignon and basil pesto shrimp, garlic-herbed roasted barramundi, and white cheddar chicken. Look, we don't always have time to cook. Even with the best meal prep delivery services, there's still a lot of chopping and cooking and time. I really struggle to make those meals in under an hour. But with Factor, there's no prep, no shopping, no thinking. And they have over 35 different options to choose from each week. They also have a calorie smart plan, a protein plus plan, and a keto plan. Plus more than 60 add-ons like breakfast, midday bites to keep you fueled and feeling good. They even have booster shots for your health. And right now, Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long with low carbon footprint meals. Just look for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu. I cannot tell you how relieved you're going to be to find those meals in your fridge at the end of the day. So head to factormeals.com/politicsgirl50 and use the code politicsgirl50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code politicsgirl50 at factormeals.com/politicsgirl50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your second box when your subscription is still active. Factor Meals, dietitian approved, lifestyle and taste bud friendly, and as my grandmother would say, delicious, nutritious. So I haven't talked about the Politics Girl premium subscriber package in a while, and today felt like the time. I'm only out of my living room and in this studio because of people who appreciated what I do and wanted to help me stay independent. I was only able to do my book, A Return to Common Sense, that's coming out in September, thanks to the patronage of the Politics Girl family. And despite the fact that they won't hear these acknowledgements because they get this podcast ad-free, I still wanted to publicly thank them for their support and let those of you who aren't subscribers know how very much it means to me to have people believe in what I'm trying to do here. As you may or may not know, I started the Politics Girl project from my home as a way to deal with my worries about the country and my fears over the direction I thought we were headed. I started on YouTube with online civics, and then I moved to the rants on TikTok as a way to break down complicated issues into bite-sized pieces, and then I started the podcast for deeper dives into important topics without the spin you get from the corporations. Over the past 4 years, my followers, people who care about democracy and truth, has grown to over 2 million people. Our videos now have hundreds of millions of views. We've won 2 Webbies, launched this podcast, and I've written a book. And I don't say that because I think I'm cool, but because I believe it's incredibly hopeful to know that there are that many people out there who care about what's going on and want to know, and quite frankly, do more. I don't like to ask for help. I find it uncomfortable. I started this project from a place of altruism, but it's taken on a total life of its own, and independent work like mine is only possible with individual support from people like you. So if you would ever consider supporting me in doing this kind of quality work, please check out and potentially subscribe to Politics Girl Premium. Click on the link in the bio, or you can click on the link at the top of the page at politicsgirl.com. Thank you. This help goes a long way, and I am sincerely grateful for your support of this show, no matter what you end up doing. Now, back to Minnie. And I really think we need to think really big about this, because it does feel dystopian, and it's also entirely plausible.
It's such a good point. When we say dystopian, it makes you think Handmaid's Tale and science fiction, but it's been happening. Like, we don't even have to go all the way back to kidnappings of Native American children. We can go back to right now, or just a few years before Dobbs, where, you know, we've already had, you know, carceral states for, you know, children of Black and brown folks who might have challenges making ends meet and providing adequate care.
Everyone has challenges making ends meet. Like,
I was going to say, after the pandemic, didn't we all experience that? Every single one of them. Can you imagine if the state came and took our children away?
I can't imagine it, sadly.
It's been happening for decades to families who live on the margins. And why are they living on the margins? Well, that's our fault as a society. It's not their fault. You know, so, I mean, we've always lived this way. But again, I mean, to Alexis's great point, we're letting this happen to white people too now. So that really tells you something.
It really does. I think ultimately this all comes back to an understanding of what the stakes are in the 2024 election and how they really could not be any higher. Obviously, democracy itself is on the ballot. We talk about that all the time. But when it comes to reproductive freedom and abortion access and the life and health and autonomy of American women and pregnant people and families in general, this is it. This is all the marbles. So how is Reproductive Freedom for All approaching November? What are your goals, and what would you, you know, what are you moving towards?
Like I said earlier, you know, we've really started doubling down on the organizing infrastructure of the org. We have 4 million members. We're 4 million members strong. So the question then becomes, if you're a member, what do you do next? What's the call to action? But it's also, you know, around a bunch of races and states that we're focused on. So right now we've got active chapters in California, Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, and Georgia. And then we have like additional paid digital organizing that we're doing nationwide, where we have members in all 50 states. And then we're also building out our ability to go into key races and states and do things like paid canvas, making sure we're doing direct mail, making sure that we're communicating the issues. And then we're working really closely with actual voters. So that's like the organizing muscle for voter contact, because there's, as we know, like since 2020, since the pandemic, there just hasn't been the same kind of grassroots organizing army in this country. And we've got to rebuild that in the democratic ecosystem. We have to rebuild that muscle. And a lot of us haven't done doors in a couple of cycles. Like the good old fashioned, roll up your sleeves, knock on a door, pick up the phone, talk to a voter. We got to get back to that, because we have more Americans than ever before who care.
Yeah.
We have a new audience of folks to pull out of their houses. And really this election is about, it's less about us versus the anti-abortion movement. We've got 8 out of 10 Americans with us. It's really about us versus apathy. I'm stealing this from another leader, but it's like us versus the couch.
Right?
It's apathy. We're not, our enemy isn't that a bunch of people are going to surge, despite what some polls might say, for Donald Trump, or that folks who are with us on abortion access and fundamental freedoms are going to all of a sudden change their mind and support, you know, RFK. But it's more that our folks might be really frustrated with President Biden, with the Middle East. Maybe they don't understand the stakes on abortion. They might not be clear on who did what. It's why the Biden campaign is doing such strong, smart messaging that Trump did this, Trump did this, Trump did this. For a lot of Americans who aren't paying close attention, they may not know how this happened. Well, the Supreme Court did this, but who appoints the Supreme Court? How did the Supreme Court get this way? How did this decision get in front of them? Like, that's MAGA Republicans and Donald Trump. So we cannot explain it enough. So there's like a grassroots organizing piece of it. And then there's like a communications narrative piece of it, which is being really clear about pinning this on who did it. And it's Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell. It's Republicans up and down the ticket. It's extremist Republicans controlling the Arizona legislature, right? It's Ron DeSantis. You know, it's Rick Scott and Ted Cruz. And we've got to be laser focused about drawing that contrast between heroes and villains here, because it's not something people intuitively know. We assume as Democratic, like high information individuals, well, everybody knows this. Democrats are pro-choice. You know, Republicans are anti, but many Americans don't.
No.
So it's about flooding the zone with the info and then mobilizing people to get them out.
Right. Well, at least President Trump is being very clear that he's taking, full credit for it, which is, he likes to get his credit. But he's also been really clear that the overturning of Roe v. Wade was his idea. He did it. He's proud of it. He'll support a national abortion ban if he's reelected, no matter what he's saying right now. And I think we need to make that very clear. You were a guest, actually, at the State of the Union of Hakeem Jeffries, the speaker, what I hope will be the Speaker of the House, but currently the minority leader.
I feel very good about the House. I mean, we still have to work really hard, but odds are in our favor.
Well, it doesn't help that they're completely useless. The Republican-led House
is only four left.
Can't get anything accomplished, But that being said, we still need to win it. We still need to keep that Senate. We still need to keep the presidency. But when you were there at the State of the Union and President Biden directly spoke to the Supreme Court justices that were there and said, we still have the power of our votes. Women do not like this. The country does not like this. And we will be heard. What was that like being in the room in that moment? Because that doesn't normally happen. That kind of a direct, you guys did this. You're part of this. And we see you and we're going to fight back.
I have to tell you, well, I was sitting next to Amanda Zarowski. So that was one piece. So I was
and
very...
And tell people who Amanda is just in case
Amanda
they don't know.
Amanda Zarowski is the lead plaintiff in the Center for Reproductive Rights lawsuit against the state of Texas around their abortion bans and their lack of enforcement of exceptions, right? And she's one of the young women who, almost went to sepsis because of a miscarriage and a later in pregnancy crisis. And it's not clear that she'll ever be able to have children now.
Yeah. And this was a child she really wanted.
And she's the subject of an ad, Willow's Box, that the Biden campaign has been pushing, where she talked about her problematic pregnancy, the fact that she couldn't get the abortion care she needed, that Attorney General Ken Paxton, has really been nasty in enforcement of their bans with almost no exceptions, and that Donald Trump did this. And Amanda's, one of those sheroes who's come out and like told her story brave and unapologetically and is now touring the country campaigning for the president. At great personal risk to herself, let's be clear, these anti-abortion folks are extremists, and she lives in Texas.
And as I understand it, she was not some pro-choice warrior before this.
She's not an activist.
No.
Just a regular, wife and prospective mom living in the suburbs, I think outside of Dallas, like just a regular gal, like Texan, did not expect to be like on the front page, like as like a lightning rod for so many extremists, but there she is. And she's doing the work because her feeling is, if something good can come out of this, I need to do it. And I need to make sure this doesn't happen to anyone else. So bless Amanda. So I was sitting next to Amanda. Like, I know the president, I work with his team. But when he looked directly at the Supreme Court and challenged them, it's what we needed in that moment. It's what I needed as a woman who's had my fundamental freedom taken away, not as an activist, not as a lobbyist, not as a campaign operative, just as a human being, to have my president look at this Supreme Court and say, enough, and I'm challenging you, and we're going to fight back. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. But having him make the eye contact, it was unprecedented. It's not normal.
Neither is the Supreme Court. They're not normal either.
No, they're not. It's not the old Supreme Court. And this is not the old Joe Biden. So that's the takeaway I want to share. Like, it felt really moving and powerful to me. And I was like, I just want to make sure we're translating that same energy. He's Fighter Joe. He's fighting for all of us. And he's ready. He is in it.
Yeah.
He is ready to take the fight to the American people. And it's not an easy thing with the president of the United States to look at the other like branch and say, I'm challenging you.
No, it's not. But I think the Biden-Harris administration has been really clear. They've done a lot to defend our reproductive rights, and they're not hedging their language, right? They have established a reproductive rights task force. They're championing the restoration of Roe, like you said, as a baseline, and the federal right to an abortion should they be reelected and get the House and have the Senate. Like, they're saying, here is what we plan to do. Vice President Harris she visited a Planned Parenthood clinic in Minnesota, and that's the first time a U.S. president or vice president has ever publicly visited an abortion provider, and she's touring the country to make it really clear where the administration stands on this kind of essential healthcare. And I just feel like they have been very, very definitive that they're clearly on team reproductive freedom. And are you feeling that too? Obviously you are.
100%.
Yeah.
And what our job is as advocates then is to make sure we're amplifying it, right? Because not everyone's watching like C-SPAN and CNN and MSNBC and like hearing about this. So what I ask your listeners and our reproductive freedom activists is to share this information. Like, it's not enough to say, it's a really important messaging vehicle and an important first step to say Donald Trump did this, but you also have to give people an aspiration, hopeful reason to vote. And that's that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will fix it along with a Democratic Congress. So it's like, they did this. They are responsible for the havoc. Democrats want to fix it. And here's how they're doing it. And these two Supreme Court cases are really interesting. The Mifepristone, the medication abortion case, and this emergency, statute case, they're both against the Biden administration. You know, they're against the Biden FDA. They're about the FDA's authorization of Mifepristone, which this administration has been really critical in making sure happened. And they're defending their own enforcement, HHS's enforcement of the EMTALA rules to provide emergency abortion care. So I point to that when I'm talking in the press. Like, Joe Biden isn't just saying words and creating task forces and doing a tour. His admin is using every single tool in their toolbox, a whole of government approach to respond to the crisis as a result of Dobbs within the scope that they can without Congress. He has to get Congress.
He has to get Congress. We got to deliver it. But I think we should also be really clear that the Biden administration, this is going to come into, like, I'm going to get into a little diatribe here, but like, they have made continued investments in our rights. I get very upset that people think he's doing nothing, like Title 10 family planning programs, national family leave programs. We recently had the first birth control approved by the FDA for over-the-counter use. President Biden signed, huge, big deal. President Biden signed an executive order to expand the federal government's research into women's health, directing the National Health Institute to spend $200 million on women's health research. And those of us who are women know.
Including on menopause.
Yeah, it's astounding how little work has been done on women's health.
On menopause.
We know nothing on menopause. We all go through it and they're like, how long do you think it'll last? I don't know, 3 to 13 years. You're like, what? Like, no one's done any research on this. Like, you know, we're half the country, right? Certain drugs don't serve us properly because they don't test them on female rats, or they don't test them on female patients because they're like, it's kind of hard to do the science because their cycles are different.
You're like, recently about like the eight hours of sleep thing doesn't apply to women anymore. It's really like 9 to 10. And I was like, I knew it.
Well, it's also like all the women that were sleep driving on like Lunesta and stuff, because they were like, well, we didn't really test it on women. And you're like, well, that's why they're getting up and sleepy, being sleep driving, because you didn't test it on us. It's absolutely insane. So the Biden administration is making all of these inroads into actual health, not just saying we're going to restore abortion care. They're like, we're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this. And I think we need to acknowledge that, but also give them back Congress so they can actually make these changes, not just say these changes, make these changes, because women and pregnant people deserve better than this. And we don't deserve to be bleeding out in hospital parking lots. And we don't deserve to be giving birth to children we're not equipped to take care of and then have them taken away from us. We're not broodmares. We're not incubators. This is not, like you were saying earlier, The Handmaid's Tale, and we can't accept that it is, right? So I think the Democrats are really smart to be making the right to an abortion one of the number one issues of the campaign, because ultimately it is not just about abortion. It's about human rights. It's about equity. It's about autonomy. Yeah. And it's about the fact that the government has no business making these life-changing decisions for us. And people need to understand how the entire anti-abortion argument is a wicked slippery slope to some sort of Christian nationalist patriotic fever dream that none of us want to live.
Absolutely. Well said. We just need to bottle that up and put it on the airwaves for everybody to hear. I will say, you know, it's become, again, I'm repeating it myself, but it bears repeating. It's become really clear that they don't care if we die. I just want to, and I'm going to repeat, like, they don't care if we die. The only people who care if we die are ourselves and maybe Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And we've got, this is a 5-alarm fire. You know, we can't take a single vote for granted. The good news is we have an opportunity. Like, we have more Americans than ever before who are clued into this new reality, who believe us, right? Who trust us, who trust women. And we have to mobilize them to put a, we have to put a very quick and swift stop to it. Like, I think it's very important and powerful that every time abortion's been on the ballot through a ballot initiative, we've won. Right. And I think it's helping in real time. When I say put an end to the anti-abortion movement, it's not just political sport. It's a deeply dangerous, like, evil movement that is literally willing to sacrifice women's lives for their theology. And we have an opportunity to shut that down. And they took 50 plus years to overturn Roe. We can fix it in two.
Yeah, we absolutely have the power to do it. So let's get it done. Honestly, ultimately, I think what we want people to remember is reproductive freedom isn't just about access to our right to the healthcare of abortion. It's about how we think our society should function. Do we believe that our most fundamental and personal decisions belong to the government, or do we believe that they belong to us? Because at the end of the day, that all comes back to democracy and if our voices are heard and respected, or if we are controlled and silenced. And like you said, we have to fight back now. We have to organize now. We have to gather now. We have to talk to our people now while we still can, because we can vote in numbers that leave no question as to what kind of country the majority of us want to live in. And I truly believe this isn't about being a Democrat or a Republican. It's about being an American. It's about freedoms. And it's about the values we believe this country should represent.
You know, it's a really great point about not being Democratic or Republican. Yeah. Because, you know, the Florida ballot initiative qualification, a really remarkable stat that's been sticking with me is like 35% of the signatures to get that initiative on the ballot didn't come from Democrats. I think it was something like 20% were Republicans and 15% were unaffiliated. So we as activists have to remember we're not just talking to Democrats, that there's a lot of independents, not affiliated or first time voters and Republicans who are with us. We know it from the data and the polling and the research and are just waiting for an invitation to be part of this. So it's exciting. We haven't won a single one of these ballot initiatives without Republicans and independents. And we've also only won them with a surge of young voters who are many of them first time engaged in activism. So this is a transformative moment. And the party, as you said, is smart to invest in it. It's also the most persuasive message to move someone from Republican voting to Democratic voting is abortion. You know, someone might say in a poll, like their number one issue is the economy, and of course, it is for so many of us, like how much do I have to pay for gas? Like, what's the cost of milk? But when you make the argument, what would change your mind about voting for Donald Trump versus Joe Biden? It's this. It's reproductive freedom.
And it's always what I say, that reproductive freedom is the economy. That is the economy. Can you afford to have another child? Can you afford to feed that child? Can you afford to send them to school? Can you afford their backpack and their clothes and their running shoes? And if you can't, why would you force me to have that child I can't take care of? Which brings us back to Dahlia. Then they won't. They'll take that child from me. And how do you feel about that?
And for folks who are uncomfortable with, you know, it's really important to shift from, like, it's not about having an abortion. It's about the freedom to decide if, when, and how to have a family.
Yeah.
So you might personally say, I'm uncomfortable with an abortion. But if you say, frame it as the freedom to decide, there's almost no one in this country, including so-called conservatives or Christian conservatives, who want the government making the decision when, if, when, and how you have your family. They want you to be able to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Even if you have a problem with reproductive technologies, you know, even if you believe life begins at conception, which is crazy, but okay, let's say you believe that. Do you want the government making those decisions for you, or do you want the independents to make that decision?
Yeah.
That's what separates us from like a place blessed like China, where they have a one child policy, which is the other extreme of the extreme like reproductive freedom you know, being taken away from people, bodily autonomy being taken away from people. And neither extreme is good.
No, I often use China as an example because, you know, they have now repealed that policy because they caused themselves so many problems because of it. And the question is, does the government have the right to interfere with your if, when, and how you have a family? And when they have, here in America, we're saying you cannot have an abortion. There in China, they were saying you must have an abortion. And both sides are wrong. And you can see from China when the government got involved, now they have entire villages that only have men. There's not a single person to procreate with. There's no one to get married to. There's no girl children. They were aborting children. They were killing girl children when they had them. It was a terrible overstep of the government, and that could be done because it was a communist government. And then you say, but we're doing the same thing here from the flip side. What are we? So we really need to ask ourselves that. Now, listen, tell people how they can follow your work, help Reproductive Freedom for All, get involved, have these conversations, do the work that needs to be done at the grassroots level.
Thank you for asking that.
So of course.
We have a challenge, become a Reproductive Freedom voter. If you go to our website, Reproductive Freedom for All, which is a lot to spell, but we will send it out. But we also have a shortcut, Repro for All. You can go to our Twitter, Repro for All. We're now on TikTok. We're now on Threads. I don't think we're on Threads yet. We're on TikTok. Although who knows how long that will last, but find us online. My handle on Twitter and Instagram is at Mintim, MINTIMM. I post all the time. What we're asking you though is to become a member, pledge to be a Reproductive Freedom voter. What that means is our organizing team will be reaching out, we'll be giving you actions, we'll be giving you ways to engage, whether it's having tough conversations with your friends and family about what's at stake, to taking an action, the text bank, a phone bank. It's never too early to organize, you know, mapping out and connecting your friends and family to ways to activate and engage is critical. And then in these key states, whether it's Florida or Arizona, we're still continuing to collect signatures. We're still continuing to be engaged in lobbying the legislature. Our team in Arizona right now has got folks every single day at the Capitol talking to legislators. All across the state, there's so much activity as an advocate you could be doing right now. And if you're not ready, and if folks are not ready to take the action to vote, there's so many other steps to take that we need you to be involved in. So sign up, reproductivefreedomforall.org. We'd really love to have you in our fight.
Yeah. And the keywords there, you guys, are freedom and all. Because ultimately, that is what we're talking about. As you tweeted back in the day, Minnie, our reproductive freedom has never been and never will be up for debate. And the fact that we are pretending it is wrong, and we need to shut that down. Thank you so much for joining me today. I love seeing you. I love the work you're doing. And I so appreciate you being out here on the front lines for all of us.
Well, I appreciate you and your listeners and your followers. You are highly informed voters and activists, and we need every single one of you in the fight.
I totally agree. They are a marvelous group, totally engaged, and they're out there, I hope, every single day talking to their people, because at the end of the day, we're responsible for our people. And with all of us together, right, we really can, like you said, took them 50 years to get here. We can change this in two.
We're going to change it. We already have. Every state that we've been on the ballot, we fixed it. So we're fixers, right? That's our generation. So we're going to get it done.
We're going to get it done. Bye, Minnie. So that was Minnie Timuraju, reminding us how much is on the line with this upcoming election. That we need to be drawing the contrast between heroes and villains when it comes to reproductive freedom. That it's not about having an abortion. It's about if, when, and how you have a family in this country. The Democrats are very clear that you should be the one making that choice, and the Republicans believe it should be them, the government. Which road do you want America to follow? I want to thank Minnie for joining us today, and you for caring enough about democracy to be here. Now go follow Reproductive Freedom for All and find a way to move up the ladder of engagement. Until next week, PGM. The Politics Girl podcast is written and performed by me, Lee McGowan, in partnership with the Midas Media Network, and produced and edited by Happy Warrior Entertainment. All rights reserved.